documentary on News Talk.
Now on documentary and drama on News Talk, we candidly recall a time before instant communication when a core group of staff manned a 24-hour office in the centre of Dublin. Their experiences and memories were captured and produced by Amandine Devine and Ellen McAvoy from the Central Telegraph's office. This is Telegram Tales.
This programme was made with thanks to funding from the Sound and Vision Scheme administered by Comisión na Man.
We had the good news and the bad news. And in between news, as I say, you know.
The only time we saw a typewriter was in the films. And the only time I heard a telegram was in the Western, where somebody came in, you know, a sheriff said, take a telegram.
If you saw a telegram boy coming with this green envelope, it was fear struck into you straight away. You know, you said, this is bad news. It wasn't always bad news, but mostly.
Do you remember the shipping messages?
Yeah.
Right, merciful hour, they were...
Difficult to understand. Yeah.
And it was DN281. Yeah. That was the code for that.
And we automatically knew every station. They all started with DN, as in Dublin. Cork would be DN221, Drogheda DN274, and I won't go on because there's lots of them.
We were 3-9 first. Just 3-9, as far as I remember, to ring for telecoms. So like, well, no, ringing from the operator. 3-9.
I'm at the General Post Office, or GPO, in the heart of Dublin city centre. This has long been a communications hub of Ireland since the 1800s. Of course, the building is also embedded into Irish history as a centre point of the 1916 Rising. You can still see the bullet holes in the iconic stone pillars out the front. But for this story, we step inside to an internal floor with windows only facing the internal courtyard, a 24-hour hub of activity connecting Ireland to the world. The Central Telegraph's office. Suspend what you know about communication today. No handheld device with a connection to the whole world. No Wi-Fi, no dial-up, no internet, no telephone landline at home, no air codes, no email addresses. And so we land in 1960s and 70s Ireland, where some homes had a telephone but most didn't. The postal system would take more time than today, and so the best way to send a quick communication was to send a telegram. Go into a post office or find a payphone and dial up 39 or later 115, speak to an operator, give them your message, and they would write it on a small slip of light green paper, charge by the word, and it would be delivered by priority. I'm Ellen McAvoy, and in this programme we will meet some of the staff who worked in the Central Telegraph's office, a 24-hour hub of activity housed on an internal floor of the historic General Post Office in Dublin's city centre. This is their story and their memories of their time in the Central Telegraph's office.
How do you? Yeah, Sean Creedon is my name. I'm a carryman in Dublin a long time. My first job was in January 1968 as a telephone installer in Cork. After spending a week in Cork, I came home to find a letter from P&T offering me a job as a post office clerk in Dublin. I thought I would end up working in the counter, selling stamps, etc. But luckily, I was sent to a fascinating office called the Central Telegraph Office on the third floor of the GPO, where I learned to type and work on telegrams 24/7. But it was a great experience. I met people from all over the country for the first time. There were 10 of us in the class, all males, 9 countries and 1 dub. And that dub, his job was to take us from Henry Street to Camden Street, where there was an office called Sight and Sound. It was a new innovation to learn how to type. And we did, I think, every afternoon. We were kind of guinea pigs. And the man in charge, Paddy Crowley was his name, he asked, was there one dub? And his name was Sean O'Connell. And his job was to take us down Liffey Street, over the Halfpenny Bridge, up George's Street, to Camden Street, where this office was located. And my abiding memory is that it never rained, which was amazing. But the two ladies doing it were tough cookies. And he was basically, you got a blank screen. And then there was a screen above. You had to press A now, B now. And I think somebody told us it was developed by somebody in prison. And it was horrible, really. Like, they were tough. I had never touched a typewriter in my life. And as I say, I thought it was going to be selling stamps or whatever. But we had to learn this typing, and we had to reach a level of 30 words per minute before we were qualified. But the target, I think we were only, as I say, guinea pigs. They dropped it. They were probably expensive, you know, to pay for the sight and sound for 10 people, whereas in-house it was free. But the typing wasn't much use, really, because when we got to we were qualified, we worked on a teleprinter. I think there was only one typewriter in the office, and that was a lady if there was a mess up of the telegrams and somebody had to retype a telegram, she would do it that way. But we never got to use the typewriter at all. But it was a great learning experience, and thank God it benefited me when I did my part-time journalism in later life. So it's a brilliant trait. You never lose it. Like I said, driving a car, once you learn to type, you have it for life, I think.
That was Sean Creedon, a proud Kerry man who found himself in Dublin among a network of people from all over the country. As did Cormac O'Brien, who hails originally from County Meath and started his career as a junior postman.
I was a junior postman for 2.5 years, but I was shipped off almost immediately to the Department of External Affairs, which is now Foreign Affairs in Stephen's Green. And I did all my time there. So I would only have to check into the GPO on a Friday when I was getting paid. Then it came to the point where you're going to be a postman, and I said no, I'm not. And then I had to make inquiries about how do I get to the next step as in a post office clerk grade B. As far as I remember, there were 12 of us, so there would have been 12 machines, and you were told sit down there and go ASDF GHJK ASDF, GHJK, and for a week you'd be doing that, and you're getting a bit, you know, fed up of it. The whole CTO area was open plan. You could stand up, as one man used to do, and we used to call him Periscope Head. He'd just stand straight up, and he'd have a look around the whole. He'd be looking at somebody doing something, and that was something he just did when he got a minute. So you could, from one end, this room was huge. I mean, at any given time, you could have 50, 60 people, and maybe even 80, sitting down at various benches, and doing various jobs. Very noisy and very dusty, because the floor was cork, and the reason for the cork floor was because there was a myriad of wires running underneath the floor, and that was what I was told. That's why, the reason for it. The cork got very dusty. And when the cleaner came in, all he had was a brush and a shovel, and he moved dust, and we all had to swallow it.
It was something new to us. We had never got a telegram, I think, at home. But then we dealt with telegrams for all over the world. If you were working night duty, there was a company called Western Union in New York, and they would send in maybe a few hundred telegrams that night, and they had to be redistributed. But the Central Telegraph Office was crucial. It was the main telegraph office in the country. It was open 24/7, 365 days a year. And then in turn, we distributed the telegrams to offices, teleprinter offices in Cork, Galway, Dundalk, Sligo, etc. And they in turn passed them on to say, if you send it to Cork, they would contact Bandon then, or Mallow, and they would deliver the telegram locally.
This is Anne Duncan from County Longford, who tells her story of how she ended up being the friendly voice on the other end of the phone when someone would ring for a telegram.
Well, I was looking for a job, of course, after leaving CERT, and I did an interview for the civil service in O'Connell Street. I got it, Brightspark. Then I arrived up anyway on the 4th July 1967. I arrived into the office anyway, and I saw it's a very big office, but I was put down over in, I was given a book to read, and that was fine. But the important thing I'd say is on my way over from the Knights, from the GPO to Cleary's side, I said, I'm going to like here that day. I just, whenever I felt comfortable with it, you get chatted up on the phone, so you get to know people in the post offices, not chatting up in the sense, some of them maybe. They say, where are you from? You know, I'd say, can't, I said, guess, you know, you kind of, never could have guessed I was from Longford or whatever. Anyway. But then again, as I said, we did elocution back in the day. And that was in our school. You pronounce your INGs and your DHs. I was coming from Ballymahon, County Longford. Like, I'd have loved to have stayed at home. You know, very few jobs at a time, local. Everybody's gone to Dublin.
With a myriad of staff from all over the country, this became a group of people working various shifts who found themselves with some free time at the heart of Dublin city centre. Overseeing all of the scheduling for this complex shift work was Michael Confrey, who hailed himself from Dublin. Michael had responsibility for making sure that all the shifts were covered at all times.
My job really was to do out the chart for the different areas in the place. Do a chart so that the overseer in charge would be able to look and see who he's due at any hour of the day. I used to do them. That had to be done every day, and everyone's breaks had to be looked after, most important anyway. So I had charts for lunch times and the casuals, as they used to call them. They were 15 minutes in inverted commas, that is. But so yeah, I had to do all that. I'd be looking at all the duties to see who's off at what time. If there was very little overtime, I wouldn't really get to know everyone on the duty, because it didn't matter anyway. But especially in the summer, when it would be a lot busier and people are on holidays as well, because the summer was the wedding time. Congratulations and best wishes.
From 3:30 to midnight, a lot of us would meet up for pitch and put. That was another new thing in Dublin. I never had seen a pitch and put course in Kerry. I didn't play golf, but we would often get together in Tulka Lodge, was a famous place up in Glasnevin, and we would play in the morning. And then we had a thing called a split duty. You'd be on from 9 to 1 and 5 to 8. And in the afternoon, we would sometimes go to a film. There was the Capitol Cinema was on Princess Street around the corner.
Savoy and Carlton in O'Connell Street.
But it was just something to do in the afternoon. Like, it wasn't much use to be off from 1 to 5. You couldn't do much.
You know? Yeah, you come out into the street and you think you're Clint Eastwood. In one particular case, there were only two people in the cinema, and I was one, and Etna Tucker was the other one. Etna was from the telephone females section.
The dog racing, there were colleagues, Murphy's, they used to go to horse racing. There was a lot of interest in horse racing, and people used to go to Bill Brady's bookmaker on across the road on Talbot Street. But Dublin... I liked it, yeah, and I think one of the tricks, I never went home too much. I found some people ran home every weekend, but I found that staying here, I got to like it, and that was crucial. Like, you know.
I didn't have a Debs or anything like that, you know, but coming up, and I remember, like, outside of that, like, fellas you'd meet or whatever, you get invited to a dress dance, and that was my God. I remember Kay Cormack gave me a pair of slippers, and somebody else, I think, gave me a bag, because I wouldn't have any of those accoutrements of the singles, you know.
We all met our wives, husbands, whatever, through the job. It was great. There were plenty of romances there, all right. Chris Bryan, do you remember Chris Bryan? She was there before me, anyway. Yeah. I'd say she started probably in 1965, and I don't know, I was very shy altogether. And she'd be after me, saying, "No," she says, "there's a lovely girl I'd like to introduce you to. She lives in Terniure, and 4 doors between them. And she said, come up and visit. Come on up, and we'll have a chat. She's a great personality." Myself and a pal went up to their house. They owned a house, but there was a lot of the family in it, so it was a well-used house. And that was in November 1967. And that was it. I'd no phone at home, and she's no phone at home. Yeah. So that was it. Yeah. And then Chris would be saying to me, "Bairn, just after getting a phone in." So I was ringing her for a few months on and off, and I was too shy to ask her out. And then Chris said to me, "Oh, she's not going out with another fella. We're not having this." So I asked her out on the phone then. And that was probably the end of March 1998. We went out on the 7th of April, 1988. I was just 18 and she was just 17. So we're only nippers.
Telegrams. And then they'd say, "I want to send a telegram to a wedding or whatever." And I'd say, "Read it back, and we'll say now it's to whoever, Mr. and Mrs. John Murphy," and then you put on the back of the telegram, "or to be fully complied with." That means that you read it back, and if there's anything that had to be kind of coded, or like F for Frank or S for Sarah or anything like that, you would have done it. I remember Jack Hart saying to me one day, 10 seconds, and I looked at him saying, "Unless everybody was busy, you should answer straight away." The junior post people then would deliver the messages in Dublin area. You know, they'd be sent next door, they'd be put into an envelope and all.
When you're on the phone and you have to send a telegram to Cleggan, you mentioned Cleggan earlier, you'd have to put on 2 headphones and all you'd hear is... You'd barely make out, and it was dreadful. People would say, "No, I'm not doing that, you do it."
Telegrams also came in on the teleprinter, and these were printed and stuck or gummed before enveloping.
They come out then into the, we call it the IR instrument room. That's where all the teleprinters, telex machines, switchboards, everything was in that room.
Yeah, well, if it wasn't done properly, it looked dirty, like, you know. But you could, that's why maybe if it was a Dublin one, it would be typed up in the typewriter. But that was rare. But it could look, they look very well when they were done well, but sometimes they were messy.
And in our case, we always dealt with gumming. And, you know, a supervisor said to me one time, "How's it going?" And I said, "I don't know whether I'm gumming or going." But in the phone section, which was all girls, they had to write out everything by hand. Whereas we had just gum.
Oh no, but we'd get, that telegram there that's sent to Sean, God bless it, that would be sent over for charging, and the charging anyway. And it was the charging and the accounts, 2 other separate duties, we'd say. And whoever's charging, they would charge up 29 words and that would go on their account. And then it would be put into an envelope and sent off. It would be sent to another place for enveloping. And the foreign ones then would be the same, but they'd be sent
Enveloping was the circulation.
Yeah.
And before it went to the circulation, the junior postman...
stamped it.
With a franking... franking machine?
Franking, yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't supposed to smudge it. which at that one is quite good, if you can see. These are just little things that the supervisors were going round and checking.
Do you remember the shipping messages?
Yeah.
My merciful hour, they were...
Difficult to understand. Long and...
Difficult to understand to write.
Yeah. You have no idea what they were on about.
I know one girl complained she'd write her scram. She shall be nameless. And I said, L-A-Z-Y.
Now, that came from Nace Post Office. And Nace rang us with that. Whereas that was sent out, that was Dublin T. The junior postman ran and collected them. Well, put them up for charging first.
Yeah.
And then the posting was another one.
Yeah.
Like for that, now for posting, it'd be somebody on it and they'd be sending out and putting it into the envelope and be collected later down with the junior postman.
And that conveyor belt was coming from the telephone section where all the girls were. It went underneath, there was a hole cut in the glass and it came all the way down to what we call the delivery table. And that's where the telegrams were picked up and sorted and sent to areas that they were supposed to be going to.
Often, a person would look to send a telegram but not be quite sure what to say. The staff remember some of their favourites.
And some of them would say, you know, have you any funny
line?
And of course, we all knew some of them. You know, I won't even go into that.
Yeah, one was "May all your troubles be little ones." That's a publisher. One you can publish. You know, I won't tell you the other ones.
But may your marriage be like our kitchen table, all legs and no drawers.
And once a king, always a king. Once a knight is enough. You know, corny stuff like that.
Well, it's funny. The other day, I was sent to somebody. I don't know why. Now we know if you're a man or a mouse. If you're a man, you'll do it tonight. If you're a mouse, you'll do it tomorrow night. But no one knew your rat. You did it last night. And if an apple a day keeps the doctor away, what can a pear do at night? Someone were a little bit, you know, they could be read out in front of the police and all like that. There was nothing really. Oh, they were harmless, yeah.
Me more than hedges running around your garden. That's probably the funniest I can think of.
In the second half of this programme about the Central Telegraph's office.
You mentioned about what was it like in Dublin. 1974. Boom.
And the GPO shook.
Reporters, I remember stuff coming in from Belfast in the Troubles.
If you were doing something and you needed confirmation and clarity about how correct this was, you sent a telegram and that telegram would stand up.
This is going to be very expensive. He said, it doesn't matter, it's a contract.
Because in those days, there was no lastminute.com.
I loved it. Well, I loved the people. I said it to Cormac, I do, it was grand. We're a very happy bunch. When we left the GPO, that was my heartbreak.
And until people start getting phones, telegrams were the only real way of communicating.
So that was the end of the CTO.
You're listening to Telegram Tales on Documentary and Drama on Newstalk. This is Telegram Tales on Documentary and Drama on Newstalk.
In the first half of this programme, we met Sean Creedon, Cormac O'Brien, Anne Duncan and Michael Confrey, all staff who worked in the Central Telegraph's office located in Dublin's GPO in the 1960s and 70s. Of course, telegrams were such an important part of life at that time, from sending a message to friends at a wedding when you couldn't make it to the wedding itself, to transferring money if you lived abroad. But they were also widely used by politicians, as part of legal contracts, and by journalists.
We also got a lot of reporters. I remember stuff coming in from Belfast in the Troubles, and the reporters from Belfast would be sending press reports to the Independent and to the Indo, the Times and the Cork Examiner and the Press, the three papers, and they would be long press, but there was a cheaper rate for press. And the other perk we got, a lot of us, we had visits from various presidents, Nixon and so-and-so, and people got to work at those. And that was a great jolly. We got to go and see how the American people work. Again, it was to do with telegrams. And I remember being working for the Nixon one, the Shannon, and they had the speech ready, knew what he said, and we were transmitting it before he had arrived.
And we got, you were talking about being treated special at times. John Paul II, he came to knock, came to Ireland in 1979. This was after the strike. And I was sent to knock with McHenry and three others. But we actually got to see the helicopter coming in, and it landed on top of the basilica, and the next thing is round the corner comes the Pope, and you were, it was lashing rain, and you just thought it, like, you, the hair on your, the back of your neck just stood up, like you're saying, I'm looking at God.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they were special times.
I remember later interviewing the Dick Klusky, one of the Klusky brothers. They had the telegram from Phil Spector, but he was their agent, and he had no way of contacting them as well. You can see it on their website. Good news. So there's a lot of things like that as well. People keep telegrams saying, people who made it a simple telegram to report to a certain office at a certain time. But so it was important that way. There was a lot of sad news. There was a lot of business news, but it was just, as Cormac said, people thought of the, when they saw the telegram boy, you thought bad news through it, the worst. But it was a means of giving a huge range of news.
But the weddings were great. The weddings were, and babies having, you know, christenings and that, and the sympathy messages, and the TDs, now they're all free. And there's a few, shall be nameless because they've passed on, but whether they have or not anyway, you could be there. You get to know them, like, and God, deepest sympathy in your supper, even deepest. And I remember one particular little old lady down the country, I don't know what part anyway, and her husband or somebody near to her died anyway, and she came on and she got me anyway, and she wanted to send a telegram back to the TD to thank him. It was a him. And I, being the nice operator I was trying to explain to her that, you know, you normally didn't reply to, because you don't, you might, when you're putting an acknowledgement in the paper or whatever anyway, you know, for mascots and all that. But because I knew she's probably a little old lady that didn't know any better, and that's not taken away from the lady at all. I can't remember if she did or she didn't, anyway, but she was very grateful that I told her. Anyway.
The other thing we used to do a lot of was, we used to have a lot of bookings for Joe Walsh tours. There'd be someone sending a telegram to the booking a pension and a booking an apartment, and Joe Walsh tours, they were the big one in those days, and they would send a telegram to the hotel in Spain reserving 2 weeks accommodation, because in those days there was no lastminute.com. everything had to be done through JWT, a travel agent, and they had to send the telegram to the hotel, I presume, or to the booking agent in Spain. That was another huge use for telegrams.
And Aer Lingus had an office in O'Connell Street when I was booking my honeymoon. You had to go to the office. Like nowadays, you just pick up the phone and you can book yourself anywhere in the world. But you had to physically go to the office in O'Connell Street and speak to somebody. I was very unfortunate one evening, and it was sort of like after 8 o'clock, all the girls had gone home, and I was on the phones, because we always manned the phones after the women left. This guy rang me and he said, I want to send a telegram to Australia. And I said, well, okay, who's it going to? And he said, the Dubliners. And I said, the group? Yeah. And he started, and he was going on for about 30 minutes, and I said, this is going to be very expensive. He said, it doesn't matter, it's a contract. I said, I'm writing down the whole contract. And he said, yes. And I was there for about 40 minutes. And my hand was getting sore. But that was very unusual. But it actually happened.
That was probably Noel Pearson.
I wouldn't even know.
Well, most people were easily understood, unless maybe to some part of the country that you mightn't just get the word. But, I mean, it was all proper English in their own dialect, we'll say, you know what I mean? You spelt out the full word, you know, it was no... Because an S and F, you know, there's few of them now that you'd have to spell out.
The telegram was a short, quick communication. Before that, Morse code messages were even shorter and, as the name suggests, code. Codes also transferred into the telegrams as a means of shortening word count and as a means of overcoming language barriers. There were internationally recognised short codes.
Before our time was the Morse, then the telegram. The telegram lasted a long time. Obviously, the word telegram was never registered. It was an international word. Otherwise, this new company would not have been able to have it. There was Morse, telegram, telex. Telex was only for business, really. Yeah. Fax was great. And in the early days of fax, when you sent it through, you got a little dot on at the back of the page to show your fax was sent. It was, yeah. But there was a code then as well for if you had got a telegram from... dealing with a French country, non-English language, there was a code, five-letter codes, and you can find them still on the web, I believe, five-letter, say, R-A-J-A-J meant your telegram is not, I can't put it, the may not be the right code, but something like that, R-A-J-A-J, means your telegram was not delivered because the address was not sufficient. And there was another thing called a telegraphic address. It'd be a short word, like for the FEI. It was Soccer Dublin. That was the address. And we kept those addresses. And if you got a message in, you had, it was just a way of shortening the things, our Estero, E-S-T-E-R-O, I think it was Foreign Affairs. And we had a list of those addresses. And we knew where to send them to.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that about the five-letter. That was the language. And when you were, if you were talking to somebody who only knew French, one particular one I remember, and we all remember it, Tunho, means I am in agreement.
T-U-N-H-O.
T-U-N-H-O.
Five-letter codes.
Only five-letter. It wouldn't, not before, four wouldn't work, six wouldn't work, five.
Many
and it was a sort of like a 60-page booklet. And you had to go through it. And like as Andy Marsh, I think he knew every word, but we would have to be looking and saying what. And speaking of Andy Marsh, I spoke to him one time and I said, when did we stop using Morse code? And he said straight away, 1963, he knew Morse code. Mm-hmm. He was working in the CTO at the time, and it was all done by Morse.
Being at the centre of Dublin City during the time of the 60s and 70s, the staff lived through a number of major historic events. In a moment, we will hear about the various impacts bombs had on the area. But first, the postworkers' strike of 1979 was of significant impact, not only to the postal staff, but all of the staff who worked in the GPO who chose not to pass the picket. And there was a far-reaching effect on the telegrams, as Cormac and Michael share now.
That was the time we went on strike for 19 weeks. And it was a Fianna Fáil government who had incredible power because they got a landslide victory and they were calling the shots. But we were looking for an increase and we were told you're not getting it. And it was decided we're going on strike.
After the strike of 1979, what they were asking was, can we destroy these? Now, there's no point. The strike, let's say 5 months. By the time you get to deal with some of them, should be 7-8 months. But
somebody has had a baby by the time you get to deal with
them.
Oh,
they're gone to school. Yeah. The decision was we cannot destroy them because a lot of these could have legal implications because business ones as well. Mm-hmm. At that stage, when we went on strike, you couldn't do international calls from your house phone. If you were doing something and you needed confirmation and clarity about how correct this was. You sent a telegram, and that telegram would stand up in court or came to it, so they couldn't destroy them.
And the outcome was that all of those telegrams were eventually delivered. Now we hear about the significant impact of bombs and bomb scares.
I was on the night duty with three other guys, including a supervisor, and around 3 a.m., boom. And our roof in the CTO was made out of glass, and it may not be glass, it might be toughened glass or plastic, but it didn't cave in. But the boom was big enough to actually, you jumped. The angel, one of the angels was blown off O'Connell, Daniel O'Connell's statue. And that was in the middle of the night, and I was actually on duty. But we just said, what was that? You know, you had no idea. And Dave Fitzgerald was going home, passing Guyney's down, what's the name of that street?
Talbot Street.
Talbot Street. And he was blown off his feet. The bomb, he was only about 50 yards away from the car bomb. And that's what Dublin was like then, in that middle 70s. And of course, there was another bomb in Sackville Street, Sackville Lane, side of Cleary's. And I was very lucky, because that's where I would have been going. But I went to the toilet before. I was at 8 p.m. I was off duty, and I went to the toilet. And I was in the toilet and I heard boom. And you said, I know what that was. And when I went out, a girl came over to me and she was crying. And she said, is there going to be another one? And I said, I can't tell you that, but like, where are you going? And she said, Santry. I said, come on, I'll walk you down. I know exactly where, because I was going out with a girl from Santry at that time. And I brought her down to the bus stop and I said, do you want me to go with you? And she said, no, I'm okay now. And months later, they reported, the Gardaí reported, that there was an arm found on the roof of Cleary's.
Well, I was actually working there when the bombs went off in the centre of the city. I was actually up in the canteen, and the GPO shook, and we were looking out the window down at Henry Street, would have been here, and there's a laneway up there and another laneway, and O'Connell Street's here, of course, and there's people running in all directions. You know, if there was another one here, some are running away from them, some are running into it. We're running around like scattering ants or something like that. They were running in all directions. It was really horrendous now. I remember one of the girls now there, she just missed it down at Talbot Street, and she was going home. She was from Donegal, and she was up in Monaghan when the next bomb went off. The bus goes to Letterkenny. I don't know, just go beyond it. I was on it once. It stops for a break at Monaghan Town, and she was there when that went off as well. She must have been terrified. I can't remember her name now. I have the face, but not the name. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a terrible time. Yeah, well, obviously, telegrams would be forwarding in all the time like that. Say, anything happens in those days, that's the only way you find out there's anyone you know or love after being blown up or whatever. You can't ring and ask. So they were all forwarding in.
Jervis Street Park, then. That was another one for her. Before Jervis Street Shopping Centre was a park down there. Yeah, but you just literally dropped everything. No bags, no coats, no nothing. Out. Then it was a clamour then, you know, we were young at the time, but people go down the stairs, like me now, you know, hanging on, you kind of know. You'd say you never get out, like, with this bomb here, we're all gone, kind of, you know, but it was big, big stuff.
But before that, I wasn't in the 66. I know that the Nelson Pillar episode was very close to the GPO. And I remember the supervisor, he spent a lot of time writing up what happened, which was really unnecessary because it was nothing to do with the GPO. But that was a big event. But none of us were on duty then, but I think it happened about 1 a.m. in the morning, and I think it damaged a little bit of the GPO. But the one Cormac talks about, that would have been 74. I suppose we were both left, I had left then. Yeah, that was in May 1974. That was the famous one.
And then there was 1969. I came in on the night duty, and I was expecting a real soft touch, which night duty always was. And the floor was a cork floor. It was covered in tape. And I said, and all the machines were going, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And I said, what's going on? I went over to Paddy Finnegan and I said to him, what happened? And he said, trouble in Belfast. And that was the start of the what we call the troubles.
The troubles, yeah.
As technology advanced and more people got telephones at home, the necessity for telegrams started to fade away. However, making a call wasn't as simple as dialing the number and getting straight through.
My first holiday was in Brighton after I changed jobs and I came into a bit of money. I called my mother, who was in Raheny, and I had to go through from Brighton to the operator in London, then the operator in Belfast, then the operator in Dublin. And finally, my mother said, hello.
And so, more and more modern technology started to replace the telegram. The telex was a more advanced form of communication that was widely used in industry and was adopted within the Central Telegraph's office. Sean quickly adapted to using this technology.
Now, telex was replaced by fax, but at the time it was huge, and our office at one end was the telex switchboard, which was a very noisy area. Really, I know a lot of people would get headaches from working there, but it was crucial in the 70s because the IDA was set up, say, a factory in Connemara or Kerry or Galway or whatever, and those people needed access to the outside world. And in those days, we hadn't got SCD dialing. That means subscriber trunk dialing, automatic phones. There was a company in Cleggan, I remember, that did fish. And they would have to ring the local post office there. Then they would ring Galway, then ring Dublin to get through. But by having the telex, they could send the telex to anywhere in the world automatically. And that was huge. But some countries, they could only dial maybe Ireland and the UK numbers automatically. But to call Brazil or South America, somewhere, South Africa, they would have to get through to the telex switchboard. And that's what we provided the service. And there were about six positions, but they were very noisy. And I remember a lot of girls would say, would you do this for me? I have a headache. You know, genuinely, she from the noise. And that was a... that was a big place. Nobody seemed to want to work there, but you didn't have to do much. You just had to press one button like a switchboard, really. There were telexes. They weren't really telegram, but basically in the same room. Fax was a... we didn't have many fax machines, no. The fax was good, but the telex was great. There were a few issues as well. People tried to... falsify a text, and I think I remember seeing a court case that people would retype it on their own machine, something that was said. But if you had investigated, you can find out the text that came in was in one color and the letter going out was in red, so an inspector, a detective, could tell which was wrong. But it was huge all over the country because the IDA were establishing these companies. And they didn't have it. They'd just buy a field, say, in Killarney or whatever, and build an industrial estate.
Each staff member spent a significant portion of their career at the Central Telegraph's office, or CTO, and look back on their time with fond memories.
I loved it. Well, I loved the people. And I said it to Cormac. I do. It was grand. We're a very happy bunch. When I retired after 31 years or 32 or whatever, when we left the GPO, that was my heartbreak. I loved the GPO. And then, you see, telemessage has taken over, and telemessage was only the 31st cousin. You know, it was the... and there's only a few of us then went over to the telephone house, which I did not like.
Well, you've great memories of the GPO. Well, I have to say, met my wife through the CTO. That was obviously the number one anyway, but... I have friends I'm still in touch with now, you know, say fairly regularly now as well. Don't mean every week or anything like that, but every month maybe. I'm still in touch with people from it.
Because everything was done manually,
you didn't, you had to have people there. But gradually we realized the new machines are coming in that are doing a lot of the work themselves. And you're saying, we're being squeezed out, and we were in the end. So that was the end of the CTO. I can't remember the exact date, but the last people who moved out, I wouldn't even know them, because I had already gone to pastors new.
That's what happened with the telegrams. People hadn't got phones. And until people start getting phones, telegrams were the only real way of communicating. And as people got more and more phones, the telegrams started to slip back as well.
I came in with 10 lads. Some of them have passed on, but I'm still friendly with all of them, like Cormac and Mick Henry in Tipperary. I'm good friends with them all. And fondest memories, I suppose, was making friends and going to soccer games, which I would never have done in Kerry. Going to pitch and put, we never saw in Kerry. Going to films. So, I mean, there was no fear of coming to Dublin. I think Dublin was safe enough then. But overall, just happy memories of the time, and just a great experience of something that stood to me for the rest of my life.
Thank you to our contributors, Anne Duncan, Cormac O'Brien, Michael Confrey and Sean Creedon. Editing and production was by Amandine Devine and Ellen McAvoy. This programme was made with thanks to funding from the Sound and Vision Scheme, administered by Comisión na Man.
Telegram Tales from the Central Telegraph's office was produced by Amandine Devine and Ellen McAvoy and was supported by a grant from Comisión na Man as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme. For more, see newstalk.com.